Catherine Amirfar.
And I'm Cal Rousdiala.
And this is
International Law Behind the Headlines,
coming to you from
the American Society of International Law.
Welcome, everyone, to another episode of International Law Behind the Headlines. I am so pleased today to be in conversation with Professor Anquita de Silva de Alves, who is a globally recognized leader on international women's human rights. She's on the faculty at the University of Pennsylvania Law School, where she also teaches at the Wharton School of Business. She was elected as an expert to the treaty body on the UN Convention on the Elimination of Discrimination Against Women, also known as CEDAW, and is the focal point on women, peace, and security. It is no overstatement to say that Anquita is an icon in the field, having published widely on some of the most critical global challenges to women's leadership and gender equality around the world. Anquita, I am privileged also to call you not just a colleague, but a friend, and I'm so pleased that you're here. Welcome.
Thank you, Catherine. I want to start by paying tribute to your vision and leadership in strengthening a rules-based international order and the opportunity that I have to work with you on bringing a gender perspective to international lawmaking at a time when the shrinking of democratic space and a growing authoritarianism go hand in hand with the reversal of rights for women in so many parts of the world. In the boundaries of international law, as you know, Hilary Charlesworth, now judge on the ICJ, bemoaned both the paucity of women and a gender perspective in international lawmaking. Your work will stand as a corrective, Catherine.
Oh, bless you. Thank you for that. And we'll get more into the details and some of the collaborations that we've had. So let me start with a table-setting question. And I think this is particularly timely because last month, as everyone knows, was International Women's Day. And we all took a collective moment to celebrate the achievements of women at the same time as we assess our progress towards a gender equal world. And this year, as you well know, Anquita, is particularly special as it was 45 years ago in 1979 that the UN General Assembly adopted CEDAW. And at the time, it was hailed as an international bill of rights for women. Anquita, to ask you a blatantly unfair question, I just want to start with the basics. How are we doing in terms of the effectiveness of global action towards gender equality?
Catherine, the transformative impact of the CEDAW can never be underestimated. Along with the transformative impact of social justice movements, such as the Me Too movement and the current Women, Life and Freedom movement. But at the same time, we live in a period where the shrinking of civic space, a growing populism and authoritarianism are correlated with a global backlash against women's rights and the rollback of prior gains in many corners of the world. Women and girls are also those most impacted by war and conflict in so many parts of the world, which once again raises the alarm on conflict-related sexual and other gender-based violence. So, Catherine, I think future generations might look back on this time as an age of crisis for women's rights. The time has come, however, to pierce the veil of impunity in terms of conflict-related sexual violence and other forms of gender violence, and to secure legal accountability and reparations. As you know, Karim Khan, the current prosecutor of the ICC, when he was head of UNITAD investigating the ISIL attacks on the Yazidis, stated that there was clear and convincing evidence of sexual violence, including rape of the Yazidis. And the latest report by the Ukraine Independent Commission on March 15th, a few weeks ago, raised the alarm of sexualized dimensions of torture. The Special Rapporteur for Torture's newest report to be submitted to the General Assembly is devoted to sexualized torture in conflict. And the report of the fact-finding mission on Iran, which released its first report in March, outlined violations and crimes under international law committed in the context of the death of Mahsa Amini. And what it stated was very interesting because it said, given the deeply rooted institutionalized discrimination against Iranian women and girls, there or transformation, including measures to overhaul criminal and civil laws and the personal status laws. So we see how these persecutions are within this context of laws that are complicit in gender subordination, and the overhaul of criminal and civil laws are part of the reformation process. So it is part of the accountability and reparations process. So as you also know, wars are raging, conflict is raging in Ethiopia, Sudan, the Democratic Republic of Congo, Middle East, and so many other geographies, which have shattered the peace in our communities and the world. And the CEDAW Committee has called for immediate access to justice, including reparations, restitutions, and rehabilitations for women survivors of sexual violence and their families. But one of the more important areas that I think bring a spotlight and create a new global public reckoning is the stunning reversals of prior gains on gender equality in Afghanistan, which is the only country in the world, as you know, that has a blanket prohibition against women's and girls' education above sixth grade. It is also the only country in the world that defines the denial of girls' education as a category of gender-based violence in its presidential decree on the elimination of violence against women. As you know, Catherine, just last week, the most recent edict by the de facto authority, the Taliban, called for public lashings for allegations of adultery and moral crimes. And as you know, I have argued that the women, peace and security agenda must be reconceptualized to include conflict-related intellectual violence as a new threat to global security. Women's bodies are not the only battlegrounds. There's a war on girls and women's education in Afghanistan, and the power and control over women's education and intellectual achievements are battlefields too. So now, working closely with you, and Deborah Voice and Oxford University, you have helped to bring together a high-level group of legal experts, including Baroness Helena Kennedy, King's Counsel, Cherie Blair, King's Counsel, several Nobel Prize winners, and some of the most distinguished Afghan women, to deliberate on gender apartheid and to recognize an institutionalized regime of systemic oppression of one gender over another, and bring an intersectional lens to this. So whether it is helping to inform the draft convention on the crimes against humanity, or to invoke gender apartheid in domestic or international courts, it is important that we continue to address the gendered boundaries of international law.
Well, thank you, Rangita. And I think, indeed, a time of crisis and also a time of hope. I think we live in this moment where we have both. And as you've said, with the shrinking of the democratic space, we see a rollback on rights. And I know that you and I spoke about this, but when the Taliban's edict restoring the public stoning of women came out, it's hard to feel anything but deep distress and regret at the kind of rollback that you're talking about in terms of the gains that women have made over the decades. So with CEDAW, as you said, there's some examples of progress, of course, but also challenges that persist. Let me do a switch topics a bit and talk a bit about your CEDAW committee work, including the 87th session in Geneva, which just so recently closed. And I know during that session, and I believe we were in real-time communication on some instances, the committee considered the reports of eight states' parties. We had Central African Republic, Djibouti, Greece, Italy, Niger, Oman, Tajikistan, and Turkmenistan, and adopted its concluding observations on each of those states' parties' reports. So the committee, at the same time, adopted statements addressing the situation of women and girls in Afghanistan, and endorsed a concept note for future general recommendation on gender stereotyping. So I want to take a look behind the curtain of this incredibly important work. And one of, I think I'd say, a very notable outcome was the invocation of gender persecution for the first time in the committee's concluding observations. Can you speak to the how of it all? What was the process, not just invoking gender persecution, but also coming to consensus about ultimately including the language of gender persecution in the observations?
Thank you, Catherine. So you and I have spoken at length and discussed very deeply the Rome Statute, which provides us with guidance on gender apartheid. But I would argue that the CEDAW preamble provides us with the textual authority too to look deep into this issue. Because when you look at the preamble very closely, you will find language to the point emphasizing that the eradication of apartheid is essential to the full enjoyment of the rights of men and women. So we can find the textual authority for apartheid within the context of the CEDAW. And given that this is the Universal Bill of Rights, we could assume that ontological and textual reading of the CEDAW would provide us to look at apartheid within the context of gender. So you asked me to raise the curtain on the CEDAW's deliberations during our last session, and it was a very, very, important session because of the ways in which it created inflection points for a lot of our conversations. So you wanted me to look at specific issues that you brought up, that is the ways in which we not only drafted a comment on gender apartheid, but for the first time, I think, in the history of the Human Rights Committee's deliberations with state parties, a treaty body invoked gender apartheid in constructive dialogues with the state party. So in my constructive dialogue with Tajikistan, since I was the country rapporteur, I commended Tajikistan for providing safety to its neighboring Afghan refugees, but also urged the non-refoulement of Afghan women. Concerned about the return of women and girls to Afghanistan, I raised the issue of the systemic and institutionalized attacks on women and girls, which could be tantamount to gender-based apartheid. So as I said, it was the first time that gender apartheid was invoked in a dialogue, and we went on to include gender persecution in the concluding observations, which form the soft law of the treaty. So the exact terms and the exact words for committee is concerned that it has compelled many women, that the state party has compelled many women to return to Afghanistan owing to their lack of means to sustain their children on their own in Tajikistan. And the committee is concerned that this may expose women to a violation of most rights under the convention, as they are compelled to return to a country where an institutionalized regime of systemic oppression by the de facto authorities may be characterized as gender persecution. So this was one of the high points of the CEDAW committee's deliberations at the 87th session of the committee. But there were many other high points, given the inflection points and the ways in which the turning points in the world have created this perfect storm of economic crisis, political crisis, and a health crisis. So, for example, we raised the issue of the rights of political protesters, where recently food insecure women have demonstrated in front of their executive officers, and the ways in which we brought up the rights of political dissenters, women human rights defenders, women journalists, and women online activists, and the way in which we addressed torture and ill-treatment, intimidation, threats, harassment, and violence, including online violence against women, human rights defenders, journalists, and bloggers, and called for, without impunity, investigate, prosecute, and appropriately punish all acts of human rights violations against journalists and women, human rights defenders. Last week, when I met with Maria Ressa, with whom you work very closely, I did share with her the news that I had raised her name in constructive dialogues with the Philippines government, calling for a larger focus on the ways in which journalists, online activists, human rights defenders continue to face persecution both online and offline, and the ways in which government impunity can create an enabling environment for such persecution, including arbitrary arrest, and the ways in which unfair detention and unfair trials against human rights defenders and journalists have aggravated the shrinking of the civic space for all women and all activists and participants in democracy. And in terms of your questions on what are the new issues that were raised at the 87th session, I think a very quick survey of that would be that we raised issues of extraterritorial obligations, calling for third states to stop transferring arms to parties to the conflict, since the CEDAW addresses extraterritorial obligations as well. And the second important issue was the issue I raised on sexual abuse by UN peacekeepers. Hundreds of women and children in the Central African Republic have reported being sexually abused by UN peacekeepers. And it has been noted by the Code Blue campaign that the UN investigated these crimes, but there is still a lack of psychological and other support, including reparations from the UN. And then the third issue, I think, is particularly salient to the work that you are doing and close to your heart, Catherine. And this was the Constructive Dialogue's engagement with Italy on its historic constitutional reform, which on climate justice, which provides an entry point to align the Convention's own General Recommendation 37 on gender and climate justice with the constitutional provisions that were newly revised in Italy. And you'll be very interested to see that those constitutional revisions are indeed revolutionary, because it calls for the protection of the environment, biodiversity, and ecosystems, even in the interest of future generations. So my question was, how can women and their leadership be harnessed as women climate defenders, especially given that this constitutional reform grew out of Italy's class action suit on climate crisis by a group of NGOs, which was very poignantly named The Last Judgment. And it did help to build a groundswell of support for the constitutional revision.
Rangita, it's wonderful that you did that. As you know, the intersection between women and media freedom and how important icons like Maria Ressa are in the fight for freedom is very near and dear to my heart. So it's wonderful, and it's always a testament to you and your platform, how you use your position in the CEDAW committee to raise these very, very important questions and points. I'm sure Maria was very glad that you were able to do that, but on behalf of women everywhere, I thank you for using that platform so effectively. I did want to ask you about another notable outcome from this session is the concept note for a future general recommendation on gender stereotyping, which I thought was very interesting. And you've obviously written on this, and you noted your perspective that culture and cultural stereotypes is not, and I'll quote you, frozen in amber. Can you expand a bit on what you mean by this and how you see a new general recommendation contributing to the thaw, if you will, of cultural stereotypes and gender stereotypes?
Thank you, because this is the general recommendation that is in our pipeline, General Recommendation 41, and I think is a general recommendation that is going to have enormous impact Given the fact that the tension between cultural practice and women's rights is the enduring women's human rights challenge, and perhaps the most profoundly complex human rights challenge of our time. As you know, Catherine, culture has the most intimate and powerful impact on women's lives. It's a site of struggle over power and control, and it is often the locus of gendered power relations in the family. And the ways in which women's rights are often subordinated at the altar of their family's culture. So what we see is that stereotypes are deeply embedded in harmful cultural practices, honor crimes, child marriage, acid attacks, female genital mutilation, dowry, maha, polygamy, virginity testing, menstruation practices, Chaupati customs, Kumari practices, a constellation of stereotypes that are deeply and inextricably integrated into cultural practices. But stereotypes are not just about stereotypes. As I said, it is a site of struggle over decision-making and control. And my own work has been looking at the stereotypes that are less visible, less overt, but are so subtle and so insidious that they are invisible to the untrained eye. So to borrow from Isabel Wilkerson, I would say stereotypes are like the wind, invisible to the naked eye, but creates destruction in its force. So how do we name the unnamed stereotype that is so subtle that it is almost inscrutable? And I argue that power is at its peak when it is least visible. So to be able to name the unnamed is, I think, what is most powerful about General Recommendation 41. And then I look at how these stereotypes can be baked into and bleed into artificial intelligence. And the ways in which right now, we're at this moment in time when 64 countries are going into polls, have an election this year. And what we see is the fear that through deep fake pornography, that we will see an erosion of the democratic space. We will see that women in politics will be leaving the political space because of the fear of deep fake pornography. And as Maria Ressa reminded me last week, untruths travel 6 times faster than truth. So how do we address this? You know, there are different tiered risk-based systems of unacceptable risks in the European Union's new AI Act. There is asymmetry in the workforce on AI. But I think what is most important is how do we address the structural and systemic biases that continue to plague us and threaten to be replicated, to be reproduced, to be digitized through artificial intelligence. So I would like this new general recommendation to have a vision of what is and what can be to anticipate the great threats of stereotypes.
Let me take you, and I'd like to stay with your theme of naming the unnamed. And I want to think about looking forward in May. So countries, as you well know, have begun submitting their reports for the committee's 88th session. What issues do you anticipate will be at the forefront of the conversation next month? What issues do you see going forward as being the most critical to achieving gender equality?
On a larger level, the CEDAW committee is profoundly concerned about the use of force by the Russian Federation in Ukraine. And our own preamble calls for strengthening of peace and security and mutual cooperation among all states, and also understanding sexualized torture as a crime against humanity. Now, that is at a large level, at the level of our constructive dialogues with state parties who are reporting to us, and our role in holding state parties accountable under the reporting mechanisms of the CEDAW, I am the country rapporteur for South Korea. So right now I'm immersed in studying the South Korean legal system and the Supreme Court decisions on gender and understanding some of the revisions that have been made, but how far the country still has to go. So as you probably know, in November of 2023, the High Court in Seoul, South Korea, held Japan liable for damages to a group of plaintiffs who had been forcibly used as comfort women in the late 1930s and early 1940s. And in doing so, the court rejected Japan's claim of sovereign immunity. So what is important here is not only Japan's culpability, but that South Korea too has responsibilities to address some of these structural and systemic root causes of sexual abuse, including revision of textbooks and introducing the concept of comfort women through a historical lens, through a gender lens in textbooks and education. A second case that has shocked the conscience of the world is the case of the Ninth Room case. I'm not sure whether you're aware of this. This was during COVID. It was the perfect storm of cyber violence, sexual exploitation of minors, and cryptocurrency. It involved the blackmail and cyber sex trafficking and the spread of sexually exploitative videos via the Telegram app between 2018 and 2021 in South Korea. And the number of confirmed victims included 50 or more minors. And it was revealed that the victims' pictures were shared and sold to over 260,000 IDs. Now, South Korea took immediate legal measures, including enacting the crime of imitative sex. I was very honored to be invited to give a keynote last August before the South Korean Constitutional Court to mark its 30th anniversary of the court. And I referred at length to this case, calling for a new human rights framework to address issues of cyber violence, but also to look at this from both the rights framework, but also through a lens of critical gender theory. So we need a new understanding of critical information theory to be able to understand the spread of misinformation, especially in terms of women and women's human rights, and the ways in which this moment in time, which is a time of, huge, it's a Promethean moment where it's a time of, as you say, of great promise and great peril. And so we need to be able to anticipate some of these harms, use the human rights framework, but also a critical information theory that looks at the human impact of these innovations, these new forms of crimes, new gender-based violence, and technology-facilitated violence against women as the newest threat to human rights. So my role with South Korea would be to look critically at some of the new reforms in the law, but also to see how those reforms have been implemented and whether women are part of that implementing leadership position.
I think that's a remarkable kind of development and approach, because as you know, the internet is gendered in the sense that these kinds of critical information theories can be very helpful in unearthing the kind of disinformation and disproportionate persecution of women in the online world. And as you know, I'm the deputy chair of the high-level panel on media freedom, and we've just begun to look at the disproportionate effect that harassment and other online tools against women reporters and people like Maria Ressa, who are documenting how the spread of disinformation exists and how women are being targeted disproportionately for that kind of online harassment. So as you say, this critical information theory is really an issue that we all need to focus on going to the future. And hopefully the Media Freedom Coalition and through your efforts and your channels with South Korea, we can start to bring more of a light and shine a light on this. So I have one final question just to wrap up, and that is, you know, we've obviously spoken a lot about the crisis. I want to end with a focus on the opportunity. What advice would you give to the men and women listening today on how to take effective action to advance gender equality?
Thank you, Catherine. So first of all, I want to frame that final question by thanking you for inspiring me to look at the role of not only women human rights defenders, but women journalists, both online and offline, as those who are safeguarding women's rights and democracy. And it is your inspiration that has really helped to catalyze a new dimension in my comments to the state parties, as well as the questions that I ask. So in terms of what are the lessons to those who are listening today, especially women law students and young legal scholars, two major issues, I think. And this first, we've already talked about, naming is an important tool for making the invisible visible. And I think it is a time once again for us to name a crime without a name. And I think both of us are working on gender apartheid. And I think that is part of that broader project of making visible the hitherto invisible. Second is the importance of storytelling to reveal the human stories behind the cases and to humanize case law. Stories are important and powerful. And I want to give you three quick examples. The first, I'm working with South Africa's Hosi Shilubana to tell her story of her journey to the chieftainship of the Valuyu tribe. So she challenged the male-only succession laws of the Valuyu tribe before the Constitutional Court. And as you know, the Constitution of South Africa, which is probably one of the most powerful constitutions of the world, has a very robust Bill of Rights protecting the rights of women, but it also recognizes customary laws. So it was a delicate balance before the Constitutional Court. And she did succeed in having the Constitutional Court recognize her as the rightful chief or the Hosi of this tribe in South Africa. Now, her journey to the Constitutional Court is an epic story. It is a chronicle of our times. It is probably an epic that needs to be told and retold. And it is as important as the decision itself. So telling her story and her journey to the South African court, along with Ma Winnie and others of her time, Nelson Mandela's first wife, is a story that I think needs to be told in order not only to understand the legal analysis, but the human story behind that. The second case, I think, that again lends itself to storytelling is the historical and ongoing struggle that is centered around the Sabarimala temple case in India, in which the now current Chief Justice, Chief Justice Chandrachud, revoked the law against menstruating women and girls entering the holy temple of Sabarimala. Here too, there are many layers of stories, many intertwined stories that need to be told. And then the final is, I'm working with Justice Ayesha Malik, the first woman justice of the Pakistan Supreme Court, to highlight her efforts to outlaw the two-finger virginity testing in rape cases in the Lahore court. Justice Ayesha Malik is now on the Pakistan Supreme Court. And it is important to show how laws themselves can be complicit in gender discrimination and gender subordination. And so it is important to work with women leaders along with our male allies to share important stories and to make visible the real life stories behind those cases. And behind the legal analysis is a subtext, a subaltern world of women's lives and the communities that support them.
Thank you very much. Truly inspiring. And as you say, it's really a matter of the stories of the women and girls around us who are not just victims, they're survivors, they're defenders, and they're on the forefront of the battle for gender equality. So thank you so much for everything that you do. Thank you for everything and all that you are. And I really appreciate that you joined us today for International Law Behind the Headlines. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Catherine. I enjoyed this.